Harrison Company to Wells Fargo during the 1980 transition period took a very different approach. While Dick Cooley systematically recruited the best people he could get his hands on, Bank of America, according to the book Breaking the Bank, followed something called the Weak Generals, Strong Lieutenants model. It works like this. If you pick strong generals for key positions, their competitors will leave. But if you pick weak generals, placeholders, rather than highly capable executives, then the strong lieutenants are more likely to stick around. The weak generals model produced a climate very different at Bank of America than the one at Wells Fargo. Whereas the Wells Fargo crew acted as a strong team of equal partners, ferociously debating eyeball to eyeball in search of the best answers, the Bank of America weak generals would wait for directions from above. Sam Armacost, who inherited the weak generals model, described the management climate. "I came away quite distressed from my first couple of management meetings. Not only couldn't I get conflict, I couldn't even get comment. They were all waiting to see which way the wind blew." A retired Bank of America executive described senior managers in the 1970s as plastic people who had been trained to quietly submit to the diktats of a domineering CEO. Later, after losing over $1 billion in the mid-1980s, Bank of America recruited a gang of strong generals to turn the bank around. And where did it find those strong generals? From right across the street at Wells Fargo. In fact, Bank of America recruited so many Wells Fargo executives during its turnaround that people inside began to refer to themselves as Wells of America. At that point, Bank of America began to climb upward again, but it was too little, too late. From 1973 to 1998, while Wells Fargo went from buildup to breakthrough results, Bank of America's cumulative stock returns didn't even keep pace with the general market. You might be thinking, that's just good management. The idea of getting the right people around you. What is so new about that? On one level, we have to agree. It's just plain old-fashioned good management. But what stands out with such distinction in the good to great companies are two key points that made them quite different. To be clear, the main point of this chapter is not just about assembling the right team. That's nothing new. The main point is to first, above all else, before everything else, get the right people on the bus, the right people in the right seats, and the wrong people off the bus before you figure out where to drive it. First the right people, then where to drive it. Not figure out where to drive it, then get the right people. The second key point is the degree of sheer rigor needed in people decisions in order to take a company from good to great. First who is a very simple idea to grasp and a very difficult idea to do. And most don't do it well. It's easy to talk about paying attention to people decisions, but how many executives have the discipline of David Maxwell, who held off on developing a strategy until he got the right people in place, while the company was losing $1 million every single business day with $56 billion of loans underwater? Would you have the discipline to wait to set your strategy until you had the right people in place if you were losing $1 million a day with $56 billion of mortgage loans underwater? That's the kind of discipline First Who requires. When Maxwell became CEO of Fannie Mae during its darkest days, the board desperately wanted to know how he was going to rescue the company. This was the early 1980s. Despite the immense pressure to act, to do something dramatic, to seize the wheel and start driving, Maxwell focused first on getting the right people on the management team. His first act was to interview all the officers. He sat them down and said, "Look, this is going to be a very hard challenge. I want you to think about how demanding this is going to be. If you don't think you're going to like it, that's fine. Nobody's going to hate you." Maxwell made it absolutely clear there would only be seats for A players who were going to put forth an A-plus effort. And if you weren't up for it, you'd better get off the bus and get off now. One executive who had just uprooted his life and career to join the team came to Maxwell and said, "I listened to you very carefully, and I don't want to do this." He left and went back to where he came from. In all, 14 of 26 executives left the company, replaced by some of the best, smartest, and hardest working executives in the entire world of finance. The same standard applied up and down the Fannie Mae ranks as managers at every level increased the caliber of their teams and put immense peer pressure upon each other, creating high turnover at first when some people just didn't pan out. "We had a saying, 'You can't fake it at Fannie Mae,'" said one executive team member. "Either you knew your stuff or you didn't. And if you didn't, you'd just blow out of here." Wells Fargo and Fannie Mae both illustrate the idea that who questions come before what questions, before vision, before strategy, before tactics, before organizational structure, before technology. Dick Cooley and David Maxwell both exemplified a classic level 5 style when they said, "I don't know where we should take this company, but I do know that if I start with the right people, ask them the right questions, and engage them in vigorous debate, we will find a way to make this company great." In contrast to the good to great companies, which built deep and strong executive teams, many of the comparison companies followed what I like to call a genius with a 1,000 helpers model. In this model, the company is a platform for the talents of an extraordinary individual. In these cases, the towering genius, the primary driving force of the company's success, is a great asset, so long as the genius sticks around. The geniuses seldom build great management teams for the simple reason that they don't need one, and often don't want one. If you're a genius, you don't need to build a Wells Fargo caliber management team of people who could run their own shows elsewhere. No, you just need an army of good soldiers who can help you implement your great ideas. However, when the genius leaves, if you were to leave, if you're a genius, the helpers are often lost. Or worse, they try to mimic their predecessor with bold, visionary moves, trying to act like a genius without actually being a genius. And that proves unsuccessful. Eckerd Corporation suffered the liability of a leader who had an uncanny genius for figuring out what to do, but little ability to assemble the right who on the executive team. Jack Eckerd, blessed with the monumental personal energy, he in fact campaigned for governor of Florida while running his company. He had a genetic gift for market insight and shrewd deal-making, acquired his way from two little stores in Wilmington, Delaware, to a drugstore empire of over 1,000 stores spread across the southeastern United States. By the late 1970s, Eckerd's revenues equaled Walgreens. And at that time, it looked like Eckerd might triumph as the great company in the industry. But then Jack Eckerd left to pursue his passion for politics, running for senator and joining the Ford administration. Without his guiding genius, Eckerd's company began a long decline, eventually being acquired by JCPenney. The contrast between Jack Eckerd and Cork Walgreen is striking. Whereas Jack Eckerd had a genius for picking the right stores to buy, Cork Walgreen, well, he had a genius for picking the right people to hire. Whereas Jack Eckerd had a gift for seeing which stores should go in what locations, Cork Walgreen had a gift for seeing which people should go in what seats. Whereas Jack Eckert failed utterly at the single most important decision facing any executive, and that is the selection of a successor. Cork Walgreen developed multiple outstanding candidates and selected a superstar successor, who may in fact prove, in the end, to have been better than Cork himself. Whereas Jack Eckert had no executive team, but instead a bunch of capable helpers assembled to assist the great genius, Cork Walgreen built the best executive team in the industry. Whereas the primary guidance mechanism for Eckert's corporation strategy lay inside Jack Eckert's head. The primary guidance mechanism for Walgreen's corporate strategy lay in the group dialogue and shared insights of a very talented executive team. This genius with a thousand helpers model is particularly prevalent in the unsustained comparison companies. Now keep in mind, these are the companies that showed a shift from good results to great results, but then lost it fairly quickly. They went from good to great and then crashed back down again. The most classic case comes from a man known as the Sphinx, Henry Singleton of Teledyne. Singleton grew up on a Texas ranch with a childhood dream of becoming a great businessman and the model of the rugged individualist. Armed with a PhD from MIT, he founded Teledyne. The name Teledyne derives from Greek and means force applied at a distance. Turns out to be an apt name, as the central force holding the far-flung empire together was Henry Singleton himself. Through acquisition, Singleton built the company from a small enterprise to number 293 on the Fortune 500 list in 6 years. Zero to Fortune 500 in 6 years. Within 10 years, he'd completed more than 100 acquisitions, eventually creating a far-flung enterprise with 130 profit centers in everything from exotic metals to insurance. Amazingly, the whole system worked, with Singleton himself acting as the glue that connected all the moving parts together. At one point, he said, or was quoted in an article as saying, "I define my job as having the freedom to do what seems to me to be in the best interest in the company at any time." A 1978 Forbes feature story maintained, quote, "Singleton will win no awards for humility. But who can avoid standing in awe of his impressive record?" Unquote. Singleton continued to run the company well into his 70s, with no serious thought given to succession. After all, why worry about succession when the very point of the entire thing is to serve as a platform to leverage the talents of your remarkable genius? That's the purpose of the company. If there is a single weakness in this otherwise brilliant picture, the article continued, it is this. Teledyne is not so much a system as it is the reflection of one man's singular discipline. What a weakness it turned out to be. Once Singleton stepped away from day-to-day management in the mid-1980s, the far-flung empire began to crumble. From the end of 1986 until its merger with Allegheny in 1995, Teledyne's cumulative stock returns imploded, falling 66% behind the general stock market. Singleton, the genius, the towering individual, the genius with a thousand helpers, Singleton achieved his childhood dream of becoming a great businessman, in the image of the rugged individualist, the Sphinx. But he failed. He failed utterly at the task of building a great company. It's who you pay, not how you pay them. We expected to find that changes in incentive systems, especially executive incentives, would be highly correlated with making the leap from good to great. With all the attention paid to executive compensation, with the shift to stock options and the huge packages that have become commonplace, surely, has to be true. We thought the amount and structure of compensation must play a key role in going from good to great. How else do you get people to do the right things to create great results? How else could we possibly explain these large amounts of executive compensation? We were dead wrong in our expectations. We found no systematic pattern linking executive compensation to the process of going from good to great. The evidence simply does not support the idea that the specific structure of executive compensation acts as a key lever in taking a company from good to great. Scott Jones and Amber Young on my team did a heroic job spending weeks inputting compensation data from proxy statements and performed 112 separate quantitative analyses, looking for patterns and correlations, trying to find the link between executive compensation amounts or structures or patterns and results. We examined everything we could quantify for the top five officers, cash versus stock, long-term versus short-term incentives, salary versus bonus, and so forth. Some companies used stock extensively. Others didn't. Some had high salaries. Others didn't. Some made significant use of bonus incentives. Others didn't. Most important, when we analyzed executive compensation patterns relative to the comparison companies, we found no systematic differences on the use of stock or not, high salaries or not, bonus incentives or not, or long-term compensation or not. In short, it doesn't really seem to matter how you compensate your executives. The only significant difference we found was that the good to great executives received slightly less, yes, less, total cash compensation 10 years after the transition than their counterparts at the still mediocre comparison companies. That's right. The ones who produced the best results on a cash basis came away with less. Not that executive compensation is irrelevant. You have to be basically rational and reasonable. I doubt that Coleman Mockler, David Maxwell, or Darwin Smith would have worked for free. And the good to great companies did spend time thinking about the issue. But once you've structured something that makes basic sense, executive compensation falls away as a distinguishing variable in moving an organization from good to great. Why might that be? Why might there be no significant correlation between executive compensation and great long-term shareholder returns? Well, think about it this way. It's a manifestation of the first who principle. It's not how you compensate your executives. The key variable is which executives you have to compensate in the first place. First who have the right executives, then what? Figure out how to compensate them. If you have the right executives on the bus, they will do everything within their power to build a great company, not because of what they're going to get for it, but because they simply cannot imagine settling for anything less. Their moral code, their inner DNA, their core values require building excellence for its own sake. And you're no more likely to change that with a compensation package than you're likely to affect whether they breathe. The good to great companies understood a simple truth. The right people will do the right things and deliver the best results they're capable of, regardless of the incentive system. Wherever you are, take in this point. Yes, compensation and incentives are important, but for very different reasons in good to great companies. The purpose of a compensation system should not be to get the right behaviors from the wrong people, but to get the right people on the bus in the first place, and to keep them there. In short, there is no such thing as an incentive system. There is no such thing as a motivational compensation system. There is instead attraction and retention systems, and compensation is about attracting and retaining the right people who are self-motivated and self-disciplined and who will produce results because it's who they are. First who, then what? We were not able to look as rigorously at non-executive compensation. Such data is not available in as systematic a format as proxy reports for top officers, which we had for the above analysis. Nonetheless, evidence from source documents and articles suggests that the same idea applies at all levels of an organization. A particularly vivid example, and in fact one of my favorites, is Nucor. Nucor built its entire system on the idea that you can teach farmers how to make steel, but you can't teach a farmer work ethic to people who don't have it in the first place. So instead of setting up mills in traditional steel towns like Pittsburgh and Gary, Nucor located its plants in places like Crawfordsville, Indiana, Norfolk, Nebraska, and Plymouth, Utah. Places full of real farmers who go to bed early, rise at dawn, and get right to work without fanfare. Gotta milk the cows, and gonna plow the North 40 before noon. Translated easily into, gotta roll some sheet steel, and gonna cast 40 tons before lunch. Nucor ejected people who did not share this work ethic, generating as high as 50% turnover in the first year of a plant. 50%, 1 in 2 don't make it. Followed by very low turnover as the right people settled in for the long haul. To attract and keep the best workers, Nucor paid its steel workers more than any other steel company in the world. But it built its pay system around a high-pressure team bonus mechanism, with over 50% of a worker's compensation tied directly to the productivity of his or her work team of 20 to 40 people. Nucor team members would usually show up for work 30 minutes early to arrange their tools and prepare to blast off the starting line the instant the shift gun fired. Quote, "We have the hardest working steel workers in the world," said one Nucor executive. And this is one of my favorite quotes in the whole book. "We hire 5, we work them like 10, and pay them like 8. Here's the key. The Nucor system did not aim to turn lazy people into hard workers. It didn't try to do that. But rather to create an environment where hard-working people, people who can't help themselves, they have to work hard because it's who they are. These people would thrive. And lazy workers would either jump or get thrown right off the bus. In one extreme case, workers chased a lazy teammate right out of the plant with an angle iron. Nucor rejected that old adage that people are your most important asset. In a good to great transformation, people are not your most important asset. The right people are. Nucor illustrates a key point. In determining the right people, the good to great companies placed greater weight on character attributes than on specific educational background, practical skills, specialized knowledge, or work experience. Not that specific knowledge or skills are unimportant, but they viewed these traits as more teachable, or at least learnable. Whereas they believed dimensions like character, work ethic, intelligence, dedication to fulfilling commitments and values are more ingrained. As Dave Nassif of Pitney Bowes put it, "I used to be in the Marines, and the Marines got a lot of credit for building people's values. But that's not the way it really works. The Marine Corps recruits people who share the Corps' values, then provides them with the training required to accomplish the organization's mission." We look at it the same way at Pitney Bowes. We have more people who want to do the right thing than most companies. We don't just look at experience. We want to know, who are they? Why are they? We find out who they are by asking them why they made decisions in their life. The answers to these questions give us insight into their core values. One good to great executive said that his best hiring decisions often came from people with no industry or business experience. In one case, he hired a manager who'd been captured twice during the Second World War and escaped both times. "I thought anyone who could do that shouldn't have trouble with business," he said. Rigorous, not ruthless. The good to great companies probably sound like tough places to work. And at their best, they are. If you don't have what it takes, you probably won't last long. But they're not ruthless cultures, they're rigorous cultures. And the distinction is crucial. To be ruthless means hacking and cutting, especially in difficult times, or wantonly firing people without any thoughtful consideration. To be rigorous means consistently applying exacting standards at all times and at all levels, especially in upper management. To be rigorous, not ruthless, means that the best people need not worry about their positions and can concentrate fully on their work. In 1986, Wells Fargo acquired Crocker Bank and planned to shed gobs of excess cost in the consolidation. There's nothing unusual about that. Every bank merger in the era of deregulation aimed to cut excess cost out of a bloated and previously protected industry. However, what was unusual about the Wells Crocker consolidation is the way Wells integrated management, or to be more accurate, the way it didn't even try to integrate most Crocker management into the Wells culture. The Wells Fargo team concluded right up front that the vast majority of Crocker managers would be the wrong people on the bus. Crocker people had long been steeped in the traditions and perks of old-style banker culture, complete with a marbled executive dining room with its own chef and $500,000 worth of china. Quite a contrast to the Spartan culture at Wells Fargo, where management ate food prepared by a college dormitory food service. Wells Fargo made it clear to the Crocker managers, look, this is not a merger of equals. It's an acquisition. We bought your branches and your customers. We didn't acquire you. Wells Fargo terminated most of the Crocker management team, 1,600 Crocker managers gone on day one. 1,600 gone on day one, including nearly all the top executives. A critic might say, and you might even be thinking, that was just the Wells people protecting their own. But consider the following fact. Wells Fargo also sent some of its own managers packing in cases where the Crocker managers were judged as better qualified. When it came to management, the Wells Fargo standards were ferocious and consistent. Like a professional sports team, only the best made the annual cut, regardless of position or tenure. Summed up one Wells Fargo executive, quote, "The only way to deliver to the people who are achieving is to not burden them with the people who are not achieving," unquote. You might be thinking, boy, that sounds awfully ruthless. On the surface, it looks ruthless. But the evidence suggests that the average Crocker manager was just not the same caliber as the average Wells Fargo manager, and would have failed in the Wells Fargo performance culture. If they weren't going to make it on the bus in the long term, why let them suffer in the short term? One senior Wells Fargo executive told us, "We all agreed this was an acquisition, not a merger. And there's no sense beating around the bush, not being straightforward with people. We decided it would be best to simply do it on day one. We planned our efforts so that we could say right up front, sorry, we don't see a role for you. Or, yes, we do see a role. You have a job, so stop worrying about it. We were not going to subject our culture to a death by 1,000 cuts. You want to talk about ruthless? To let people languish in uncertainty for months or years, stealing precious time in their lives that they could use to move on to something else, when in the end, they're not going to make it anyway. That would be ruthless. To deal with it right up front, to be honest, to be forthright, to be consistent, and to let people get on with their lives, that is rigorous. Not that the Crocker acquisition is easy to swallow. It's never pleasant to see thousands of people lose their jobs. But the era of bank deregulation saw hundreds of thousands of lost jobs. Given that, it's interesting to note two points. First, Wells Fargo did fewer big layoffs than its comparison company, Bank of America. This is the power of comparisons. Wells Fargo looks rigorous and ruthless for cutting all of these people out, but then you look at the comparison and find they did it even more. Second, upper management, including some senior Wells Fargo upper management, suffered more on a percentage basis than lower-level workers in the consolidation. Rigor, rigorous, not ruthless, in a good-to-great company applies first at the top, focused on those who hold the largest burden of responsibility. To be rigorous in people decisions means first becoming rigorous about top management people decisions. I remember writing Good to Great, and I feared that people might use first who rigor as an excuse for mindlessly chopping out people to improve performance. I still worry about that. It's hard to do, but we've got to be rigorous. I read it in Good to Great. I can hear people say this, and I cringe. For not only will a lot of hard-working people get hurt in the process, but the evidence suggests that such tactics are contrary to producing sustained great results. The good-to-great companies rarely used headcount lopping as a tactic, and almost never used it as a primary strategy. Even in the Wells Fargo case, the most extreme in our study, the company used layoffs half as much as its comparison company, Bank of America, during the transition era. We went back and analyzed the role of layoffs in restructuring. Here's what we found. 6 of the 11 good-to-great companies recorded 0 layoffs from 10 years before the breakthrough date all the way through 1998. And 4 others reported only 1 or 2 layoffs. Let me just stop and think about that for a moment. These were companies that had to change their performance. These were companies that had terrible to, at best, good performance. And 6 of 11 of them recorded 0 layoffs from 10 years before their breakthrough all the way up through 1998. And only 1 or 2 layoffs in 4 of the others. Now let's look at the comparisons, where in contrast, we found layoffs used 5 times more frequently than in the good to great companies. Some of the comparison companies had an almost chronic addiction to layoffs and restructurings. It would be a mistake, a tragic mistake, to think that the way you ignite a transformation from good to great is by wantonly swinging the axe on vast numbers of hardworking people. Endless restructuring and mindless hacking were never and are not today part of any good to great model. Rigorous, not ruthless. How to be rigorous. We've extracted 3 practical disciplines from the research for being rigorous rather than ruthless. Practical discipline number 1. When in doubt, don't hire. Keep looking. One of the immutable laws of management physics is Packard's Law. so-called because we first learned it in a previous research project from David Packard, co-founder of the Hewlett-Packard Company. It goes like this. No company can grow revenues consistently faster than its ability to get enough of the right people to implement that growth and still become a great company. If your growth rate in revenues consistently outpaces your growth rate in people, you simply will not, indeed you cannot, build a great company. Those who build great companies understand that the ultimate throttle on growth for any great company is not markets. It's not technology. It's not competition. It's not products. It is one thing above all others: the ability to get and keep enough of the right people. The management team at Circuit City during its transition era instinctively understood Packard's Law. Driving around Santa Barbara the day after Christmas a number of years ago, I noticed something different about the Circuit City store. Other stores had signs and banners reaching out to customers. Always the best prices, or great after-holiday deals, or best after-Christmas selection, and so forth. Then I looked over at the Circuit City store. It had a banner that read, "Always looking for great people." The sign reminded me of our interview with Walter Bruckert, vice president during the Good to Great years. When asked to name the top five factors that led to the transition from mediocrity to excellence, Bruckert said, and I quote, this is a direct quote, "One would be people. Two would be people. Three would be people. Four would be people. And five would be people. A huge part of our transition can be attributed to our discipline in picking the right people." Unquote. Bruckert then recalled a conversation with CEO Alan Wurzel during a growth spurt at Circuit City. "Alan, I'm really wearing down trying to find the exact right person to fill this position or that position. At what point do I compromise?" Without hesitation, Alan said, "You don't compromise. We find another way to get through until we find the right people." One of the key contrasts between Alan Wurzel at Circuit City and Sidney Cooper at Silo, which is the comparison company to Circuit City during the transition era, is that Wurzel spent the bulk of his time in the early years focused on getting the right people on the bus, whereas Cooper spent 80% of his time focusing on the right stores to buy. Wurzel's first goal was to build the best, most professional management team in the industry. Cooper's first goal was simply to grow as fast as possible. Circuit City put tremendous emphasis on getting the right people all up and down the line, from delivery drivers to vice presidents. Silo, in contrast, developed a reputation for not being able to do the basics, like making home deliveries without damaging the products. According to Circuit City's Dan Rexinger, "We made the best home delivery drivers in the industry. We told them, 'You are the last contact the customer has with Circuit City. We're going to supply you with uniforms. We will require that you shave, that you don't have body odor. You're going to be professional people.' The change in the way we handled customers and making a delivery was absolutely incredible. We would get thank you notes back on how courteous the drivers were." 5 years into Wurzel's tenure, Circuit City and Silo had essentially the same business strategy, the same what? Yet Circuit City took off like a rocket, beating the general stock market 18.5 to 1 in the 15 years after its transition. While Silo, which had the same strategy, keep in mind, same what, bumped along until it was finally acquired by a foreign company. Same strategy, different people, different results. Practical discipline number 2. When you know you need to make a people change, act. The moment you feel the need to tightly manage someone, you've likely made a hiring mistake. The best people don't need to be managed. Let me repeat that. That's one of the key points of this whole book. The best people, the right people on the bus, don't need to be managed, don't need to be disciplined, don't need to be motivated. Guided, taught, led, yes, but not tightly managed. We've all experienced or observed the following scenario. We have a wrong person on the bus, and we know it. Yet we wait. We delay. We try alternatives. We give a third and fourth chance. We hope that the situation will improve. We invest time in trying to properly manage the person. We build little systems to compensate for his or her shortcomings, and so forth. But the situation doesn't improve. When we go home, we find our energy diverted by thinking or talking with our spouses about that person. Worse, all the time and energy we spend on that one person siphons energy away from developing and working with all the right people. We continue to stumble along until the person leaves on his own, to our great sense of relief, or we finally act, also to our great sense of relief. Meanwhile, our best people wonder. They're looking at us thinking, what took you so long? Letting the wrong people hang around is unfair to all the right people, as they inevitably find themselves compensating for the inadequacies of the wrong people. Worse, it can drive away the best people. Strong performers are intrinsically motivated by performance, and when they see their efforts impeded by carrying extra weight, they eventually become frustrated. Waiting too long before acting is equally unfair to the people who need to get off the bus. For every minute you allow a person to continue holding a seat when you know that person will not make it in the end, you are stealing in the worst way. You are stealing a portion of that person's life. Time that he or she could spend finding a better place where he could flourish. Indeed, if we're honest with ourselves, the reason we wait too long often has less to do with concern for that person and more to do with our own convenience. He's doing an okay job and it would be a huge hassle to replace him, so we avoid the issue. Or we find the whole process of dealing with the issue to be stressful and distasteful. So, to save ourselves stress and discomfort, we wait. And wait. And wait. Meanwhile, all the best people are still wondering, when are they going to do something about this? How long is this going to go on? Using data from Moody's company information reports, we were able to examine the pattern of turnover in the top management levels. We found no difference in the amount of churn, turnover within a period of time, between the good to great and comparison companies. But we did find differences in the pattern of churn. The good to great companies showed the following bipolar pattern at the top management level. People either stayed on the bus for a long time, or got off the bus in a hurry. In other words, the good to great companies did not churn more. They churned better. The good to great leaders did not pursue an expedient try a lot of people and keep who works model of management. Instead, they adopted the following approach. Let's take the time to make rigorous A-plus selections right up front. If we get it right, we'll do everything we can to try to keep them on board for a long time. If we make a mistake, and all of them made mistakes, then we will confront that fact so that we can get on with our work and they can get on with their lives. I need to underscore a key point here. The good to great leaders would not rush to judgment. Often they invested substantial effort in determining whether they had someone in the wrong seat before concluding that they had the wrong person on the bus entirely. This is a key premise or a key principle in this chapter. If you think you might have a bus problem, ask first, perhaps I have a seat problem. When Coleman Mockler became CEO of Gillette, he didn't go on a rampage, wantonly throwing people out the windows of a moving bus. He spent fully 55% of his time during his first 2 years in office jiggering around with the management team, changing or moving 38 of the top 50 people. That's pretty amazing, you think about it. 38 of the top 50 people he moved around to get it right. Said Mockler, every minute devoted to putting the proper person in the proper slot is worth weeks of time later. Similarly, Alan Wurzel of Circuit City sent us a letter after reading an early draft of this chapter, wherein he commented, and this is Wurzel, "Your point about getting the right people on the bus as compared to other companies is dead on. There is one corollary that is also important. I spent a lot of time thinking and talking about who sits where on the bus. I called it putting square pegs in square holes and round pegs in round holes. Instead of firing honest and able people who are not performing well, it is important to try to move them once or even two or three times to other positions where they might blossom." It might take time to know for certain if someone is simply in the wrong seat or whether he needs to get off the bus altogether. Nonetheless, when the good to great leaders knew they had to make a people change, they would act. But how do you know when you know? Two key questions can help. First, if it were a hiring decision rather than a should this person get off the bus decision, if you were hiring this person all over again from scratch, would you hire? Second, if the person came to tell you that he or she is leaving to pursue an exciting new opportunity, would you feel terribly disappointed or secretly relieved? Practical discipline number 3. Put your best people on your biggest opportunities, not your biggest problems. In the early 1960s, R.J. Reynolds and Philip Morris derived the vast majority of their revenues from the domestic arena. R.J. Reynolds' approach to international business was, if somebody out there in the world wants a camel, let them call us. Joe Kullman at Philip Morris had a different view. He identified international markets as the single best opportunity for long-term growth, despite the fact that the company derived less than 1% of its revenues from overseas. Kullman puzzled over the best strategy for developing international operations, and he eventually came up with a brilliant answer. It wasn't a what answer. Following the principle of first who, it was a who answer. He took his number one executive, George Weissman, off the primary domestic business and put him in charge of international. And think about this. There's only 1% of the business at the time. International amounted to almost nothing, a tiny export department, a struggling investment in Venezuela and another in Australia, and a tiny operation in Canada. That's it. When Joe put George in charge of international, a lot of people wondered what George had done wrong, quipped one of Weissman's colleagues. Said Weissman himself, I didn't know whether I was being thrown sideways, downstairs, or out the window. Here I was running 99% of the business, and the next day I'd be running 1% or less. Yet as Forbes magazine observed 20 years later, Kullman's decision to move Weissman to the smallest part of the business was a stroke of genius. Urbane and sophisticated, Weissman was the perfect person to develop markets like Europe, and he built international into the largest and fastest growing part of the company. In fact, under Weissman's stewardship, Marlboro became the best selling cigarette in the world 3 years before it became number one in the United States. The RJR versus Philip Morris case illustrates a common pattern. The good to great companies made a habit of putting their best people on their best opportunities, not their biggest problems. The comparison companies had a penchant for doing just the opposite, failing to grasp the fact that managing your problems can only make you good, whereas building on your opportunities is the only way to become great. There's an important corollary to this discipline. When you decide to sell off your problems, don't sell off your best people. This is one of those little secrets of change. If you create a place where the best people always have a seat on the bus, they're more likely to support changes in direction. When Kimberly Clark sold the mills, Darwin Smith made it clear. The company might be getting rid of the paper business, but it would keep its best people. Many of our people had come up through the paper business. Then all of a sudden, the crown jewels are being sold off, and they're asking, "What's my future?" explained Dick Ochter. And Darwin would say, "We need all the talented managers we can get. We keep them." Despite the fact that they had little or no consumer experience, Smith moved all the best people from paper to the consumer business. We interviewed Dick Appert, a senior executive who spent the majority of his career in the papermaking division at Kimberly Clark. The same division sold off to create funds for the company's big move into consumer products. He talked with pride and excitement about the transformation of Kimberly Clark and how it had the guts to sell the paper mills and how it had the foresight to exit the paper business and throw the proceeds into the consumer business and how it had taken on Procter & Gamble and won. "I never had any argument with our decision to dissolve the paper division of the company," he said. "We did get rid of the paper mills at that time, and I was absolutely in agreement with that." Stop and think about that for a moment. The right people want to be part of building something great. And Dick Appert saw that Kimberly Clark could become great by selling the part of the company where he had spent most of his working life. The Philip Morris and Kimberly Clark cases illustrate a final point about the right people. We noticed a level 5 atmosphere, a level 5 team culture at the top executive level of every good to great company during the key transition years. Not that every executive on the team became a fully evolved level 5 leader to the same degree as Darwin Smith or Coleman Mockler, but each core member of the team transformed personal ambition into ambition for the company and for the team. This suggests that the team members had level 5 potential, or at least they were capable of operating in a manner consistent with the level 5 leadership style. You might be wondering, what's the difference between a level 5 executive team member and just being a good soldier? The difference is this. A level 5 executive team member does not blindly acquiesce to authority and is a strong leader in her own right. So driven and talented that she builds her arena into one of the very best in the world. Yet, at the same time, each team member must also have the ability to meld that individual strength into doing whatever it takes to make the company great. One of the crucial elements in taking a company from good to great is somewhat paradoxical. You need executives on the one hand who argue and debate, sometimes violently, eyeball to eyeball, like those Wells Fargo executives, in pursuit of the best answers. Yet, on the other hand, who will unify fully behind a decision, regardless of their personal or parochial interests. An article on Philip Morris said of the Coleman era, "These guys never agreed on anything, and they would argue about everything. And they would kill each other and involve everyone, high and low, talented people. But when they had to make a decision, the decision would emerge." This made Philip Morris. "No matter how much they argued," said a Philip Morris executive, "they were always in search of the best answer. In the end, everybody stood behind the decision. All of the debates were for the common good of the company, not your own interests." First two, great companies and a great life. Whenever I teach the good to great findings, someone almost always raises the issue of personal cost in making a transformation. In other words, is it possible to build a great company and also build a great life? Or do you have to choose? The answer is yes. You can have both. The secret to doing so lies right here in this chapter. I spent a few short days with a senior Gillette executive and his wife at an executive conference in Hong Kong. During the course of our conversations, I asked them if they thought Coleman Mockler, the CEO most responsible for Gillette's transition from good to great, had had a great life. Coleman's life revolved around three great loves, they told me. His family, Harvard, and Gillette. Even during the darkest and most intense times of the takeover crises of the 1980s, and despite the increasingly global nature of Gillette's business, Mockler maintained remarkable balance in his life. He did not significantly reduce the amount of time he spent with his family, rarely working on evenings or weekends. He maintained his disciplined worship practices. He continued his active work on the governing board of Harvard College. When I asked how Mockler accomplished all of this, the executive said, "Oh, it really wasn't that hard for him. He was so good at assembling the right people around him and putting the right people in the right seats that he just didn't need to be there all hours of the day and night." That was Coleman's whole secret to success and balance. The executive went on to explain that he was just as likely to meet Mockler in the hardware store as the office. He really enjoyed puttering around the house, fixing things up. He always seemed to find time to relax that way. Then the executive's wife added, "When Coleman died, and we all went to the funeral, I looked around and realized how much love was in the room. This was a man who spent nearly all his waking hours with people who loved him, who loved what they were doing, and who loved one another. At work, at home, in his charitable work, wherever." The statement rang a bell for me, as there was something about the good to great executive teams that I couldn't quite describe, but that clearly set them apart. In wrapping up our interview with George Weissman of Philip Morris, I commented, "When you talk about your time at the company, it's as if you're describing a love affair." He chuckled and said, "Yes, other than my marriage, it was the passionate love affair of my life. I don't think many people would understand what I'm talking about, but I suspect my colleagues would." Weissman and many of his executive colleagues kept offices at Philip Morris, coming in on a regular basis long after retirement. A corridor at the Philip Morris World Headquarters is called the Hall of the Wizards That Was. It's the corridor where Weissman, Coleman, Maxwell, and others continue to come into the office, in large part because they simply enjoy spending time together. Similarly, Dick Appert of Kimberly-Clark said in his interview, "I never had anyone in Kimberly-Clark in all my 41 years say anything unkind to me. I thank God the day I was hired, because I've been associated with wonderful people. Good, good people who respected and admired one another." Members of the good to great teams tended to become and remain friends for life. In many cases, they are still in close contact with each other years or decades after working together. It was striking to hear them talk about the transition era, for no matter how dark the days or how big the tasks, these people had fun. They enjoyed each other's company and actually looked forward to meetings. Imagine that. They looked forward to meetings. A number of the executives characterized their years on the good to great teams as the high point of their lives. Their experiences went beyond just mutual respect, which they certainly had, to lasting comradeship. Adherence to the idea of first who might be the closest link between a great company and a great life. For no matter what we achieve, if we don't spend the vast majority of our time with people we love and respect, we cannot possibly have a great life. But if we spend the vast majority of our time with people we love and respect, people we really enjoy being on the bus with, and who will never disappoint us, then we will almost certainly have a great life, no matter where the bus goes. The people we interviewed from the good to great companies clearly loved what they did, largely because they loved who they did it with. Summary points. First who, then what. The good to great leaders began the transformation by first getting the right people on the bus and the wrong people off the bus, and then they figured out where to drive it.